welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 289 of the podcast, and it is the 1st of October 2016 as I record this, and it's pouring with rain outside, and the weather has definitely turned. Autumn is truly here. It's getting chilly now, and I know I will be packing extra warm clothes to head off to Denver in a couple of weeks, and then also the Oregon coast, which I think will be cold and wet. I think Oregon's pretty famous for that. Then I'm off to Israel, so very excited about that. Lots of travelling in the next month for me. Right, today I have an interview with David Wood, and we're talking about writing series that actually sell, and also how David grew from one book under one author name to running a small press. We talk about changes in the audiobook market, which is fascinating, and also expanding into co-writing and Kindle Worlds. Now, I know we talked about fiction series last week with Toby Neal, but David has a different take, and I think you'll really enjoy this. And I think it's interesting as well, as more and more indies move into creating small press, and we talk about the sort of ramifications of that as an author. Okay, in publishing news this week, Kobo expands into Taiwan, continuing their march into other territories. And I recently ran my Kobo Writing Life sales map again, and now I've actually sold books in 84 countries through Kobo, which I'm always thrilled to do that. Kobo Writing Life is still the only sales platform that has a map of your various sales on, and I always love that as a travel junkie. That's exciting because I have not been to 84 countries. Nook Press also announced that they are offering free as a pricing option, which of course you've been able to do through Kobo, Drafts of Digital, Smashwords for a while, and you can distribute through to Nook from sites like Drafts of Digital or Smashwords, but maybe it will encourage Amazon to go the same way. Or maybe Amazon will stick with only allowing people on KDP Select to do free. Who knows? But yeah, Nook Press do that. I fear it's too little too late, but we shall see. Also, lots of kerfuffle this week around Amazon review policies. The announcement about some big scammer who is making loads of money from page views and bots doing reviews and stuff like that. And, you know, to be fair, reviews are always going to be difficult. But Amazon has changed their review policy, so customers have to have spent more than $50 to leave a review, and I presume that means $50 ever. Now, I certainly know that I've spent a lot more than that on Amazon over the last, 10 years, however long? At least eight years, it must be. I think that's interesting. I think it's a very good development. It should get rid of the bots, because basically if you want to set up a bot, you're not going to have the bot spend $50 in order to leave a review. It's going to change a lot of things, hopefully. But again, the point is, do not be swayed by the ups and downs of this type of thing. Do not let it disturb your equilibrium. Just keep on writing quality books for your target market, and quality will win in the long term. And also, you have to enjoy the process. The whole point of this is that you enjoy your life writing. You enjoy your life in general, but writing should be a happy thing for you. It shouldn't be about trying to avoid scammers or worrying about people who are making money by scamming the system. Who cares? You know, just get on doing what you love and focus on the good side. Yeah, that's my attitude anyway. I just let these things wash over me, just roll off my back. But on the topic of scammers, I did actually want to point this out, because this is a service I really want to get everybody sharing. I get emails all the time from people who have paid one of the vanity publishers and got burned or been pitched. And I also saw an advert on BookBub for one of these scammy publishers and got quite upset about it. So what I want, and I can't name names because many of these companies are quite litigious, and I don't want a lawsuit. But the Alliance of Independent Authors has a wonderful new watch list listing of all the services, including many of these dodgy publishers. So if you go to selfpublishingadvice.org, there is a link, a watchdog link on the menu, and then a service rating. And I'll put the links in the show notes. But if you go to selfpublishingadvice.org, go to the watchdog link and the service ratings, and you will find there a list of the services and publishers that are recommended and those that come with a warning. So really good place to have a look if you get pitched by a company, or if you're thinking of using some kind of self-publishing service, have a look at that. That will help a lot. Also, please direct any author friends to that as well. Very important that we get the word out about services that are, ripping off authors. What I get annoyed about with this type of stuff is that many traditionally published authors, I'm in a few Facebook groups with a lot more traditionally published authors in, and you know, their comments sometimes suggest that they equate these types of scammy services with the way that I publish and the way that you potentially publish, which is I'm an indie. I go direct to the, you know, services like KDP, like Kobo Writing Life, like iBooks. I don't use these services. Now, there are some very good services for people who don't want to do it themselves, but also there are some dangerous ones. So once again, go to selfpublishingadvice.org and that watchdog listing. Okay, so I am, this week I've been prepping for Denver. As before I recorded this, I did a run through of the talk I'm giving at the Digital Commerce Summit in Denver. I'm pretty excited about it, actually, trying to sort of educate people around intellectual property rights to do with books. And I'm very excited about learning a whole load of stuff there. I've also been working on End of Days again. I had a bit of a pivotal moment, came up with the last few scenes that I wanted to do. So I've started on the home straight of that. So 54,000 words in, and I intend to get another 10-15 done in the next week. And then I will take it away with me, because editing is quite a good thing to work on while traveling, and I will be adding to it while we're in Israel, because we're visiting Megiddo, which is the biblical Armageddon and also features in the book End of Days. Of course, you can't write a book called End of Days without visiting Megiddo, so I will probably be rewriting that scene, because I know they've got a new visitor center and all kinds of exciting things. So that's good. I've also been reformatting my ebooks this week after some feedback from a reader that my Look Inside pages on Amazon were weirdly formatted. And indeed, I went and had a look, and these are the Look Inside on the Kindle file. So the print file are fine, but the Kindle files had some weird formatting. And I love Scrivener as writing software. It is designed as writing software. Now, I've been using it to format as well for years now, but I certainly, let's say I don't care enough about formatting to spend a long time on it. And obviously there were a few issues. Now, rather than try and figure out what the hell I was doing wrong, I've just shifted to Vellum for ebook formatting. I've heard a lot of good things about Vellum. And so this week I thought, right, I'm going to fix this problem. I'm just going to get Vellum software and deal with it. It's Mac only, sorry, Windows users, but I love it. It's so simple, and you can find it at vellum.pub. It really is brilliant. So I'm working through my backlist at the moment. I've done most of my fiction. I'll be working on the nonfiction and just trying to make all my formatting consistent, and also sort of redoing all the back matter and all those things that, we often leave. Some of my books I haven't touched for like 2 years, so I'm updating quite a lot of the back matter at the moment. So that's exciting. And one of those jobs that I know people who are not comfortable with technology struggle with, which is why I think Vellum's awesome. But also I like having the control of the formatting. I think it's really great. You know, I love being able to change some things in the books. I actually went through and changed a bit of the pacing when I looked at my earlier books. I was scared of the return key, as Dean Wesley Smith talks about, often with, you know, with thrillers, you don't want huge blocks of text on the page. You want faster paragraphs. And if you look at a James Patterson novel, you'll see what I mean. There's a lot more white space, whereas literary fiction novels tend to be quite dense. And even just that visual sense and the pace of reading the pages matters. So I've been doing a few things like that, you know, not necessarily changing the text, but just changing the paragraph breaks, which actually moves things faster. Also this week, very exciting, Destroyer of Worlds is now out in audiobook format. I do have some review copies. So if you love audiobooks and you like thrillers and you want to try Destroyer of Worlds, Arcane Book 8, please email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, if you would like an audiobook review copy, as I do have a few. Okay. Oh, and if you do email me, please tell me whether you're US UK Audible store so I can send you the right code. Right, so thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. I love getting them. And we actually had a few really interesting ones this week. Nathan Van Koops probably wins for the most awesome tweet. He sent me a video of dolphins playing and said, "The dog and I are enjoying dolphins chasing their lunch while listening to a podcast from the Creative Pen," which is awesome. So yeah, video of dolphins, that's got to win. It's amazing. Angie Wagner, also, you know, brilliant picture. "I'm listening to your episode from spring where you talk about the seasons of writing while I literally harvest," and sent me a picture. Like, it looks like she's on a combine harvester, which is pretty cool. Philip says, "Great podcast with Dan Wood on going wide with Drafter Digital. My new trilogy will be wide." Fantastic. Libby Cutts, "Listening to the back issue podcast, striding up and down, mowing the lawn at my gardening day job. Lots to think about." And yeah, I mean, when I had a day job, I did listen to a lot of audio. It was a massive thing for me in terms of changing my mindset. So I'm so glad it helps. Just a couple more. Carlin Jones, "Listening to the show while praying my new mums survive our 90 degree Georgia fall weather." Picture of sprinkler on plants. And Cynthia Varady says, "Changing it up, listening to the author abundance episode while making dinner instead of during my run on a sick day." And a picture of a lot of onions and peppers. Get well soon, Cynthia. Okay, thanks as ever, everybody, for your emails and tweets. And I really love to know what you're doing while listening to the show and any pictures of where you are around the world. I love the interaction that we have on the show, and I really appreciate you getting in touch. So you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Now, today's episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I have a word from our sponsor coming soon, but also a tweet from Mark Lefebvre from NINC, the NINC conference, says, "I meet so many Creative Pen listeners everywhere I travel. Thank you, Joanna, for helping virtually introduce me to so many great writers." And a couple of people tweeted that they recognized Mark from his voice because he's Canadian. They recognized his voice from the podcast and went over to talk to him at NINC. So I think that's really cool. Makes me very happy. And Mark is super helpful. So definitely, if you see him at a conference, go say hi. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. And a massive thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And at the beginning of the month, I always want to say a big thank you to you all. Your sponsorship has now enabled us to move to one commercial sponsor. I have retired 99 Designs because, let's face it, they are everywhere. So Kobo is now our main corporate sponsor, and the rest of the shows are supported by you guys on Patreon. Thanks to all of you, and especially new patrons Ruth Wetherill, Elizabeth Eves, and Anthony Mark Tilt. And for Patreon subscribers only, I'll be recording that extra Q&A show this week. So please enter your questions on the form. You know where it is. And if you would like the extra monthly audio, including the last, 9 months worth of extra 45-minute shows, 30 to 45-minute anyway, of Q&A, you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. And even just $2 a month to get those extra audios. Okay, so a word from our sponsor, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. What is Kobo? Kobo is a global ebook company born out of Canada. Kobo is available in 190 countries around the world. Now, authors like Joanna Penn already are taking full advantage of the fact that while there may be certain players, world's longest river, that exist and are quite prominent in a few nations, Kobo is available and continuing to expand and grow in territories around the world. And one of the wonderful things about being a Kobo Writing Life author is when you look at that dashboard and you see that you sold a book in some country that you probably haven't heard of before. Check us out at KoboWritingLife.com. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
And today I'm here with David Wood. Hi, Dave.
How's it going?
Oh, it is good. And just a little introduction for anyone who doesn't know Dave. David is the best-selling author of the Dane Maddock action-adventure thriller series and also writes fantasy novels under David DeBoard. And he runs Griffinwood Press, a small indie-minded publisher, and runs the AuthorCast podcast with Alan Baxter, who was on the show just a few weeks ago. Now, very exciting because you were on the show in August 2011. So it's been over 5 years, which is amazing. And of course, you and I have connected since then, but you haven't been back on the show. So I wanted you to start by telling us what has changed in your author life since you were last on the show, August 2011. How have things changed for you?
Okay, we have an hour just to answer that question, right? In 2011, I had just left my day job. I had two books in my Dane Maddock series and a couple other things. At that point, indie was a hobby. I was alternating between action adventure and fantasy. I had done a historical fiction patio book. I was just testing the waters with different things. But fortunately, I got in early on Smashwords, got in day one on Kindle, staked out my little spot in Men's Adventure. And so by the time I started working on the third Dane Maddock book, which is when I was on your show last, I was able to leave my day job. And so the first step of the evolution was to be able to write more once I was full-time, be more productive, have more time to devote to learning the ins and outs of indie publishing, keeping track of what's changing because it's always changing. The next step was when I added co-authors and then added new lines, both expanding the Maddock universe and coming up with other series. So from having three Dane Maddock books and a few other things, I now have 22 in the expanded Dane Maddock universe. I finally finished my fantasy trilogy. Took me forever. And I've got a few other things going. And I just signed with Kindle for a Dane Maddock Kindle World. So yeah, things are just getting bigger and better. And in my personal life, the big difference is my wife recently left her job to manage the household so I can be full entrepreneur because, you know, she had a good job as a forensic scientist. But, you know, we're fortunate like some indies that we got to the point that we didn't really need the income anymore. And it was more of a help for her to take care of all the family things that I was doing. So that's the big difference for me in my personal life.
Wow. And the thing is, it gives me chills, actually, because our path is so, well, not similar in that, you know, you've done a lot of things I haven't and vice versa. But, you know, we both left our day.
Parallel.
Like we both left our day jobs in 2011 and we've both helped our other halves to leave their day jobs in the last year. So I think I hope people are really encouraged by that, because what it shows is if you put in the consistent work over a number of years, things can be quite dramatically different. Can't they?
Yeah. And I'm a hack. So if I can do it, anyone can do it.
And you mean hack in a good way, just in case.
Modern day pulp writer.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that. Let's talk about it now. So there were three Dane Maddock books. Now there are 22. Now, and I started writing my Arcane series and I'm just writing book 9. So I am well behind, but you have all these co-authors and things. So what I wanted
to... And a lot of them are novellas and short novels as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted to start by asking you, how did you know that was the right series to focus on? So when you had three and you went, okay, I'm going to double down on it. Like, what was the point at which you went, this is the series I need to focus on? Like you said, you only just finished your fantasy trilogy. Why didn't you focus on that? Like, what was the decision process?
Book sales, mostly. Basically, I wrote the first book slapped it up on Lulu.com back in the bad old days when the only self-publishing option was an overpriced paperback. And I was surprised that it sold okay. And that got me interested in at least continuing with action adventure, because I liked action adventure, had always read things like Doc Savage, the old Clive Cussler stuff, loved Indiana Jones, but I also had a passion for fantasy. So I decided it was at least worth trying a second book. And when I got to the second Matic book, I loved the process. I was very fortunate that Jeremy Robinson, who was a successful action adventure author and been sort of a mentor to me, he read it, gave me a great critique. And I said, I can really do this. And this is fun. And fortunately, the sales continued to snowball. And I felt not only for the economic aspect, but I just had a lot of excitement. I felt that although I was doing sort of Cussler-esque things, yeah, I had my own twist on it with the pulpy little veneer that I was putting over it. So it was a combination of enthusiasm. And as things have gone on, I really let the market dictate where I go, because I'm sort of in the Russell Blake camp. I'm producing a product for sale. I love doing it. I'm passionate about it, but this is my job.
Yeah. So when you say you let the market dictate where you go with it, what do you mean in terms of that? Like, are you looking for story ideas that the market responds to? Or, what do you mean specifically?
Mostly in terms of where I put my time and energy. At this point, I still write some fantasy and I do put some effort into marketing those. But the Dane Matic and similar series are where I've really put my most branding and marketing efforts. And also, as I've chosen to add new lines, we're focusing more on the things that people love about Dane Matic. For example, I have a new book called Blood Codex with Alan Baxter, who you said you just had on the show. And we made sure, although it's got its own twist and it has some of Alan in there, it's very much directed toward the people who love Dane Matic and might want a newer, slightly more grown-up series.
Mm. And that is based on the Codex Gigas, isn't it? The one I also used in Crypt of Bone.
Right, I thought of that.
Yeah, I was thrilled to see it. And that's what I love. I mean, I actually think readers of the action adventure thriller stuff that we write like to see the same things coming up, like the Ark of the Covenant.
I think so.
Stuff like that. You know, there are things that we all write about that are all slightly different. Like, I remember reading, which of your books has Petra in it?
The very first one, Dorado.
Oh. Okay, well, I still remember that. And when I wrote a scene in Petra, I was like, I have to make sure it doesn't read like David's.
Yep, and I thought of you with the Devil's Bible. But when, with the Dane Matic main adventure series, I definitely cover some of those tried and true things. Mm. You mentioned the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, Excalibur. When I announced I was doing Atlantis, some of my writer friends were like, don't you think a lot of people have done Atlantis? Yeah, they all sell.
Exactly.
And then I did Noah's Ark. So, yeah, as long as you're doing something fresh, people are happy to read about a new twist on it. I, as a reader, like to read those sorts of things. And I base a lot of my creative decisions on what I would like to read.
Yeah, exactly. And so I hope people are also encouraged by that, because just because someone else has written a book around a particular thing, you can still do it too, right?
Right. It's one of those foolish things you hear a lot of novices worry about. What if somebody steals my idea? I don't want to join a writer's workshop because somebody will steal my idea. What if the editor steals my idea? Everybody could start with the same idea. We could take 100 writers and we'd have 100 different books. Ideas are cheap.
Yeah.
It's your execution that's important.
Exactly. And yeah, that's very cool. Okay. So I want to ask about how, like you mentioned there, you actually called it the Dane Matic universe, which I thought was kind of awesome. So how did you make the decision? Because it's kind of letting go of some control. Okay. One, you're working with co-authors. Let's just talk about that first. So you're working with co-authors. Is it the James Patterson model where you outline and they write? Or how are you working with co-authors in the Dane Matic world?
Specifically in the Dane Matic world, it's mostly the James Patterson or really Clive Cussler model. A lot of my writer friends have written with Clive. It started out just as a test balloon. I had written in Jeremy Robinson's universe, so I knew how it could work and that readers could potentially enjoy this. Mm-hmm. And just like a book should start in medias rea, the series of Matic really does. They're already treasure hunters. They've already left the seals. They've had adventures. Important people have died. So I would get questions from readers about things they would like to know more about and asked if I would ever write a prequel. So this was an opportunity to start exploring some of those things and to work back and forth, plant Easter eggs, and have a little fun. So it started out as one book. It did well. And then I slowly expanded, first by adding to the Origin series and then bringing in some new series with existing characters. And how I work just depends on the author. With Sean Ellis, for example, he and I, we've been friends since a Yahoo Adventure Writers group way back before either of us was ever published. Our styles are very similar. Our tastes are similar. And he doesn't need a lot from me. So we brainstorm, we get together at the Doc Savage convention every year, and we kick around ideas. He takes it and runs with it, touches base when he needs help, and then I make a quick pass over it. With the other authors, I've gravitated more and more toward a very thorough outline, big spreadsheet form, and in some cases, it's a few paragraphs per chapter. Sometimes I'll even insert bits of dialogue I definitely want them to say, because Bones, the sidekick, is very unique.
And he's very witty.
He is my voice. Yes. He's my voice more than anybody. So the other authors get more and more of an outline ahead of time, and then they execute it. But with all of them, I make a pass over it. And then, so I do a heavy spreadsheet, and then the authors complete it. I make a big pass over it. Really, with all of the books, regardless of who I'm writing with, I make the final pass. It goes to the editor, and I do the final edits on it. So I touch it last, no matter what the process was leading up to that.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I haven't read all 22. I've read a good number of I know. I feel terrible, but I've read a number of them. So I'm wondering then, with Kindle World, so you've kept quite a tight control over the content so far, but Kindle World means... how are you going to handle Kindle World in that you literally can't, you don't have any control, right?
It's a big leap. I'm not exactly sure how it's all going to shake out. I was cautiously optimistic when they approached me, but one of the great things, as you know, about being an indie is building that community that can help you. So I reached out to some of our mutual friends like CJ Lyons and Russell Blake, who have the Kindle Worlds, got their guidance. I wanted reassurance that it wasn't going to dilute my product and cost me sales. None of them had that experience. So at this point, the first stage is that I'm going to line up authors and use my usual process, and that will be the first quote-unquote wave of Dane Maddock Kindle World stories. So I will have curated them, and I'll promote them heavily. And then once that gets going, I will at least use my platform to promote any new stories that come out. I probably will not treat them as canon. I doubt that I'm even going to have time to read them all.
Yeah.
I'd like to. But it's going to be interesting, but there are a lot of interesting wrinkles about the way it works. For example, with the setup I've chosen, which is the one I'm told Joe Conrath and some others did, an author could bring in their own character or create a new one and retain the rights. So if you want Morgan Sierra to team up with Bones or Jade or somebody, you could do that, and I don't get rights to your character. So there might be some really cool things that people do, but I think we'll probably not have to fret too much about canon with some of those, because invariably we're going to cover some of the same territory. I can't stop somebody from writing a new Ark of the Covenant story. So we'll just see how readers perceive it, but I think it's exciting. It's a lot of possibilities, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah. So, well, does that reflect your personality then? Because you do seem pretty laid back about that thought. And I'm just looking behind you. You've got a lot of Captain America. You've mentioned Doc Savage. Yeah. So does that mean you have an idea for the Maddock universe that it does become something much bigger than where you started?
I can't honestly say that because for a couple of reasons. One is that my entire career is unplanned. I think the indie life for those of us who are successful is a constant process of assessing and adapting, seizing opportunities, experimenting and discarding what fails. So I couldn't have made a 5-year plan and followed it because you just don't know what's going to change in the market. You can have goals. So at one point, I did want to keep a firm hand on the Maddock universe. The Dane Maddock Origins was only supposed to be in the Navy SEALs and nothing fantastic whatsoever. And the Dane Maddock main series was only going to be the fantastic, and I would only be the one to write anything other than Origins. But I am kind of relaxing the reins. I don't know. Like you said, I am generally laid back. As long as I do my due diligence and get my questions answered, I don't feel as precious about my work. And it could be also that we're developing some new series that people are enjoying, and I'm kind of realizing, yes, Matic is my baby and my special snowflake, but I can do other things too.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. And you mentioned there sort of learning from what's failed. So I'm really interested now, you mentioned it. So what has failed over the last 5 years?
All of my relationships. failed. I was thinking more in terms of certain marketing techniques, certain mostly in the micro. I keep a master list of all the different promotional sites, for example, and keep track of how they do, and some are just garbage, and they weren't worth my money. Let's see. Failure is a difficult word to apply to my young adult paranormal satirical books that I wrote, because I only wrote one in each series and didn't really make any attempt to continue. So I chose to abandon them because they didn't get off to a very good start. I don't know if I could call them failure unless I really applied the same work ethic and effort to them that I do with my other stuff. But that's a failing to some degree. So that would probably be in terms of writing, the ones that really just crashed and burned. And at one point, my first collaboration with Alan, Dark Wright, which was a horror novel, was a minor failure. It really didn't catch on. But the interesting thing is, now that Blood Codex has taken off, we're seeing a big boost in that book, even though it's been out for several years now. So, jury's out on that.
Well, okay, that's really interesting, but all of what you've said then, you only have one in each series for those young adult books, and
right.
The one you did with Alan, which was a standalone, which I read, which is great, Blood Codex, Dark Wright.
Dark Wright was the horror novel standalone, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what you've now shown with doing the second one with Alan is that even though it's not a direct series, people are seeing it as, okay, this is like two in a row, so therefore the first one's selling. And it possibly, if you wrote more in those other young adult books, the first ones would sell too. And do you think an overarching tip for anyone writing as an indie is write a series? Like, is that just, you know, that's what you have to do? Like, a standalone will never do very well.
Obviously we won't say never, but if your goal is commercial success, absolutely. I think your best choice is to sort amongst the various genres you enjoy reading. Pick one that looks commercially viable, that you're enthusiastic about. Don't be mercenary and pick something you hate just because it's has potential. But pick something you love, has potential, and yes, commit to writing a series. That is going to give you the best. It buys you more lottery tickets than writing a single book does.
Yeah, which is funny because, like, way back, probably 5 years ago, when Hugh Howey broke out with Wool, he said he wrote 5 different novellas and saw which one sold and then carried on writing in that series. I don't think that would work anymore. I think there is too many things around.
Well, it could be a measure of what you're best at, possibly. Put them all out and see which one readers respond to. But early on, I would prefer going with a series. I would rather not do the testing the waters thing in that way, but some of it depends on your personality and how quickly you write. If you can crank out 5 novellas in a short period of time, go for it.
Yeah. Okay, so I also wanted to ask you about the Jade Ihara spinoff, because how many books did you have in that?
We have 2 at the moment. We've been doing 1 a year, and it'll probably be the middle of next year before we get to the third one.
Yeah.
But Jade has been well received. She's a notch below Matic in terms of sales. But the interesting thing with that is that some of the feedback I get from the Matic readers is that they didn't buy it, not because she's female, but because they didn't like her in the Matic books, because she did some things in the first book. She was sort of a double agent, not completely her fault, but she made some people mad, in part because she was part of the Matic love triangle and everybody was rooting for the other girl. And then also, she's kind of in your face. I wrote her with a certain personality, very specifically. I think that in a lot of ways, I wrote her as the kind of person I hope my daughters will become. I really emphasize how I think for women in general to be successful in the world, maybe you have to be a little more assertive and aggressive than a man and really stand your ground. But unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the world who don't like that in a female character. But overall, we've been very pleased with how she's been received. Then we also have the Myrmidon Files. We were working on the second book in that series. And while that's more of a Sigma Force style book, the main person is an African-American female who is almost entirely borrowed from a good friend of mine who's just crazy and awesome. So it was important to me to put some strong female action adventure characters out there. I really wanted to do that, mainly because I'm a dad of two girls and a big brother to four sisters.
Yeah, well, you know, I have my strong females, and I actually have an African-American character as well in America, who was in One Day in New York, and I'm bringing her back next year as well. So I think, you know, it's great to be doing these different things. Okay, so I want to kind of talk about Griffinwood, because, well, I guess, first of all, maybe just start by explaining what Griffinwood is.
Big old pain in my butt. Back when I first developed a passion for indie publishing, we actually called it self-publishing back then.
Oh, yeah.
The stigma was great. And so I moved from Lulu to Lightning Source, created a publishing imprint, because even then I recognized that as long as the book is good, the cover is good, price is competitive, readers don't really research the name of the publishing house and find out how legit it is. So it started out as an avenue for me and two other people to get our books out there under an imprint name, and it grew. At this point, we have, I think, 10 authors in-house, but we're in the process of breaking it out with an imprint called Adrenaline Press. Because right now we've got a mishmash of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and action-adventure thrillers, pulp. So everything action-adventure, contemporary thriller, and classic pulp adventure is Adrenaline Press. And Griffinwood is now grouped into fantasy, science fiction, and urban fantasy and horror. And so it is my micro press that I operate.
Well, it's not quite so micro anymore. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I guess not. But that's mostly my fault. I can make a publishing house out of the Matic world.
Yeah, well, and that's, I guess, what I'm wanted to ask you, because what's happening now is everybody, well, not everybody, obviously, new people come in every day, but quite a lot of the authors that we started with around 2011, some of the bigger names like Marie Force and Liliana Hart and, you know, a lot, and yourself, have started their own presses and are now publishing other people, which, you know, and I said indie-minded press because you're an indie, but actually people who publish through Griffinwood are not indie, they're publishing through you are a publisher. And what's funny is, you know, a lot of indie writers have negative views of publishers, and yet you're an indie and a publisher. Right. So how do you reconcile all of that in how you work and also in making sure that you're doing the right thing for everyone?
It's mostly a partnership. I give the authors more feedback on their final product. I make a pass over the book when they submit it. If I think it's acceptable, I send it on to the editor. If I think there are certain changes to be made, I'll say, this is what I think you ought to do, but ultimately it is your book. And then I make a lot of the marketing decisions. I encourage them, I coach them, and try to get them to do the right things. One of the paradoxes of running a press like this today is that you really do need the authors to still use the best practices of an indie to help you along. Yet most of the authors who have that personality are just going to go at their own anyway. Mm-hmm. So at this point, I try to be conscious of trying to be as helpful to them as I can and to try to make sure there are things I can offer to them that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And what I find is that at this point, I have some very talented authors who just don't want to be bothered with the publishing process. They don't have a passion for it, and some of them don't really want to put the money into it. So in some cases, that's what I'm offering them.
Well, it's interesting. And I mean, one of my thoughts is, you know, going back to the days when Apple was on the edge and trying to compete with Microsoft. And what we see historically is the outsider becomes the mainstream. So, and what I'm wondering, and I've said this to the guys at Self-Publishing Podcast, you know, Sterling and Stone now employs all these people and they want to be a story studio and make movies, and they have like 7 or 8 imprints. And a few years ago, they were just indie writers. So, you know, what do you see going forward for Griffinwood? I know you said you don't have a plan, but now you have all these writers and you have a universe. And, you know, do you see that in terms of the publishing hierarchy, you know, the smaller indie-minded companies are going to grow and try and take market share?
Where I see certain publishing houses excelling would be a publishing house like Cohesion Press or Severed Press that's choosing just a few things they're going to do extremely well. They're going to get the best cover artists for these particular genres, editors who know the genre inside and out, focus on a few lines, and cultivate an audience that loves the work that they do. Those are the small ones that I think are really making some noise right now. They're not trying to be everything. And that's a mistake I made with Griffinwood that I'm trying to rectify. So what I see with Griffinwood is being more tightly focused. With Griffinwood one, Adrenaline the other. I would like to develop our own mailing lists for each, just like an indie author would do, and find ways to engage the audiences who like that specific type of work. And I might even create more imprints to divide it even further. But I think specialization is going to be a key for a solid indie press. They're not going to try to compete across the board in every genre, but to do a few things very, very well and focus on audience engagement.
Which is hard for everyone. And, you know, it is interesting how there are a number of digital presses now that are standing out because they do that. They're focusing. And like, I mean, if BookBub opened up their audience to like publish people, everyone would be like, yeah, sure, I want to publish with BookBub because they have an email list. It's kind of the same with Amazon, right? The reason people want to be publishing with Amazon is because of their email list. Yeah.
And their way of engaging with the consumers. That's ultimately the key in the digital age, is making those connections with people who've never heard of your work but would probably like it.
Which is crazy, because it used to be that the reason to go with a publisher was to get a physical book in a bookstore.
Right.
But now it's more, you know, have you got an email list? So I think that's quite funny. And so let's talk about audio, because I have my first three novels through Griffinwood with audio, because when I wanted to do audio and we were talking and you were like, you know, I'll help you, because ACX wasn't available. Now, ACX then became available, but interestingly, it became available in the UK, what, like 2 years ago now, but it's not moved any further. It's not available to other indies in other countries. So, and things have really changed with audio. I know you have a lot of audiobooks. What are the changes you've seen with audiobook income, and is it still worth it? You know, what's going on?
Right. Well, I think first of all, we got into ACX early. And that was a good thing, because at that point you had the traditional published authors to choose from. But a lot of the people like me who love audiobooks and are hungry for them, we would go through our favorite genres pretty quickly. So it wasn't nearly as competitive. Now everybody's getting in. There are lots of people, just like there are a lot of really bad authors out there throwing their hat in the ring, there are a lot of bad narrators and producers who have joined ACX. And so there's bigger glut. And unfortunately, ACX doesn't have the good discovery tools that Amazon – nobody really has the good discovery tools that Amazon does. So it's there are a lot more fish in the pond. It's more difficult to be discovered. And we don't have access to the things that make indies successful in ebook, like price control, freebie promos, being able to run special sales to discount below the traditionally published books. We're all right there together. And it's, you know, can be difficult to stand out. So I think that's one of the reasons the income has been going down, is just we can't do the things that indies do to be successful. There are some things we can try. Audiobook Boom is a mailing list you can use to get your name out there. Occasionally you'll get opportunities to discount your books, but that's something Apple does on their own. You don't have any control over it. So where I see indies being successful in the future, and even right now, is building up on your own until Audible takes notice of you and buys your book from you. That's something that's happening with a lot of my friends, is they build up enough audience that they get a sweet deal from Audible and Audible takes it over. Another thing is perhaps you've built up enough of a track record that some people are now selling to Graphic Audio. They'll start a bidding war between Audible and one of the few others. So that's one possibility for people at the top end. And another might be a return to giving it away free. There's a site called Scribble that will allow you to post your book through them, not only to Audible and iTunes, but also Podiobooks. And then some people are starting to use YouTube. I've started a YouTube channel, and I'm doing some of my audiobooks as free videos, because there are millions and millions of people using YouTube, and perhaps that's an untapped market. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. In any case, those are potential revenue streams. Even if Audible income continues to be stagnant, it's money I wouldn't have if I didn't do an audiobook version. And some people look at that as another sign of legitimacy if you're also in audio.
That's interesting. On the YouTube thing, are you actually sitting there on video reading, or do you just upload the audio with just an image?
Audio with a cover image is what I've done. Right now I've got one book and one short story that are not exclusive with Audible or with ACX, so I've put those up. And I may continue to do some of my shorter works as non-exclusive and use those as promotional tools.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm selling my nonfiction direct now from my website as audio, so selling that myself. But I, you know, although I'm getting, you know, decent money for smaller sales, you know, what you get with Audible is still you get the reach, so you get different people. Right. So it's really hard, isn't it, to kind of know, and where do you think it's going to move in terms of what's going to come for audio? Do you think someone's going to actually take Audible on?
I hope so. One of the challenges of direct sales is that consumer behavior is that people prefer convenience over price for the most part. Mm. I've tried selling my books on my own 2 weeks in advance of release at a 50% discount and didn't sell any, or sold one, because people don't want to be bothered. Mm. Somebody will take Audible on and maybe give us some of those tools that we don't have right now. But another thing, and I'm just hearing rumors and secondhand information, but some of my friends who have contracts with Audible are being approached about some new programs in markets that don't have Audible right now, where it's going to be streaming content, and the payment structure is going to be, it almost sounds more like KU. I don't know any specific details, and I'm curious whether streaming is the future for everyone, if it's just they're testing it out in certain markets, but I do know at minimum that Audible has some plans to expand into some new markets, but I would be cautious when they approach you until you understand better what the compensation is, because it sounds like, based on what I'm hearing, that they're trying to get people to go ahead and commit to a long-term thing without really knowing what kind of potential revenue they have.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And, you know, the thing is that it's about convenience, isn't it? And getting it on your phone, and Audible have done a very, very good job of becoming ubiquitous. Yes. And I mean, I even joined Audible eventually and now listen to audiobooks. So it is kind of crazy how that's changed. Okay, so just, you know, still kind of on audio, is that you run AuthorCast podcast with Alan, and that's been going for years as well, which I was just looking back, and you know, that's been running for years. So have you found that podcasting is a good form of marketing, or is it just something you do for fun?
It's definitely just for fun. I actually have started another podcast that I'll talk about in a minute, but AuthorCast is Alan and I talking about things that our wives don't have any interest in talking to us about, mostly. Sometimes we talk about the craft of writing, sometimes talk about the market, sometimes we review books, but it's a chance for me and a good friend to talk about things we're passionate about. I'm sure some people did discover our books through that, but you know, I couldn't make a living off of the AuthorCast audience buying my books. So I would say podcasting is, do it if you think podcasting would be fun, if you're good at managing your time and not letting it eat up your life. Alan and I we're bad podcasters. Some people, the best ones, podcast on a schedule. We do it when we're ready. Sometimes, mostly it's, we try for once a month. Sometimes it's 2 weeks. Sometimes it's 5 weeks in a row. But it's very much us having a good time and talking about what we love. And we've made some good connections. I think the positive for us is that we've been able to have authors like yourself on, and many others. And because we're giving them that platform, they've done things for us in return. I found one of my co-authors that way. A couple of them have been on there. Authors who have been on the show have been happy to share announcements of my new books, to blurb my books, things like that. So it's an opportunity to build relationships too, which is a lot of fun. And, you know, I go to Thriller Fest and interview some people that I've connected with, or maybe get to catch up with people who've been on the show. It's a great entree. You know, you don't just go up and say, "Hi, I'd like you to be my friend because you're a big author." You can say, "Hi, I run this podcast. Would love to have you as a guest because I love your work." And that's step one into building that relationship. You give first and then people give back.
Yeah.
So that's AuthorCast. Yeah. And then my other podcast, which I think I'm 7 or 8 episodes in, is called Wood on Words. And it is focused on indie publishing success. I did an indie success workshop at Balticon, or I tried to, and an hour in, I realized I wasn't anywhere close to being finished because so many people had questions. There was so much to cover. So I said, I'm going to turn this into a podcast. So that's my way of giving back, because I'm at a great point in my life where indie publishing has been good to me, and I want to, you know, share some things that I learn and continue to learn. So that one is purely giving from a business standpoint.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And that's what I say to people too. Like, you know, when I started podcasting in 2009, you know, I didn't have a mailing list. I was nobody I didn't have Twitter. I had nothing. And I just started it to connect with people and to try and do something technically that most people can't do, you know, create a video or an audio that people can share, which people actually value very much, don't they? And everyone loves talking about themselves for half an hour. Coming back to Thrillerfest, why do you keep going? Like, you're successful, you're an indie, it's a very traditionally published, dominated conference. You know, obviously both of us like to go and fangirl boy over Clive Cussler, you know, but why else do you go?
Well, let's see. One is an opportunity to make some professional connections. Different cons have different value. I mentioned Doc Savage Con. I go there because I actually sell books. People love adventure there. And I get to hang out with people who love the same kind of things I do. I get to brainstorm with Sean. Balticon, for example, is an excellent one because that one's attended by a lot of entrepreneurs and podcasters and indie publishers. And they have a lot of panels. So that's good for my brand and for connections in the indie world. And then Thrillerfest is good for professional connections. I would mostly advise it if you were going to look for an agent or a publisher for a manuscript. That's, I think, the best reason to go. I went in part just for fun because I hadn't been in a while. The family wanted to go to New York. Biggest reason to go to any con is it's a vacation you can deduct from your business expenses. But I got a face-to-face meeting with iBooks and got to talk about better ways to be successful with them and make some connections there that have been helpful. That the making those personal connections is an excellent thing always, especially when you're dealing with some of these places that are going to help you sell. I got to meet with Kindle person and get some questions answered that I had concerns about. I don't like it for indie publishing, as you said. For one, the little bits of advice that you hear are very, very basic. And anybody with any level of experience, anyone who listens to podcasts has already heard it all. And you really aren't going to meet too many readers there other than other authors who also read. I was sitting in one panel and the moderator asked for a show of hands, how many here are writers? All but two people raised their hands out of more than 100 people. So it's mostly authors and wannabe authors there. And it's a lot of traditionally published people. And actually, I'm in a very small Facebook group with people like CJ Lyons and Russell Blake and those guys where we trade information. And I kept a running Thrillerfest thread for them because some of the marketing advice that people were giving was just ridiculous. Like one person, they asked, how do you market your book? And one guy says, well, you know, I always see a big increase when I appear on Fox News. And one person said, well, you know, when my new book came out, I videoed me doing a dance and I tweeted it. I'm sure that sold some books. And I wish I had kept this thread. You and I should get offline and I'll just read it all to you one day. So after a few of those type things, I ignored the business panels and went for craft and informative things. Like there was a fantastic one on the lives of Navy SEALs from authors who were also ex-SEALs. That was amazing. So if you go to Thrillerfest, I would say stay away from the business and craft stuff because you're going to get mostly superficial advice from people who are accustomed to being taken care of by traditional publishers. And there's nothing wrong with that path, but I'm assuming that people that are interested in your podcast probably are not on that path.
Yeah, well, and I was going to agree with you in that I think why I go is to hear about the writing side, like, you know, how longevity is something I'm really interested in the market. So, you know, people like David Morrell and Lee Child and people who've been writing for years, so long that their advice around, and people like Donald Mars, who's kind of is an agent and anti-indie, but his advice on writing is good, you know. And sure. So this is the thing. I think what's so interesting about the sort of hierarchy of conventions is you go to different things for different reasons. And for me, Thrillerfest really is that kind of, I get to go and learn. I do get to go on a panel sometimes, but I'm there, generally, I'm there as a kind
of... They'll give you one to throw you a bone.
Exactly. But I'm mainly there to kind of sit at the feet of authors who've been doing this for 30, 40 years and who are not indie. In general. So it's really interesting, isn't it, how we get these different things. But what you said about personal connection, that's the point. And I got to meet Blake Crouch, and Blake Crouch is one of those people who's gone from being at edge of horror indie with Joe Comrath to like 7-figure book deal and a TV show and all this, you know. He did Wayward Pines, if people don't know. And I'm just like, that's cool.
I think
cool.
He's in Kindle Worlds too.
Yes, he is. Wayward Pines is. And so people know, I've talked about this before, but Kindle Worlds isn't open to non-US writers. So I wanted...
I don't understand.
I know, it's kind of crazy, but I wanted to...
And apparently the books can't be in Kindle Unlimited, even though they are Kindle exclusive,
yes.
Which I also don't understand.
I talked to Toby Neal about this, either the show before yours or I can't remember, but she was saying the same thing. And I'm like, it seems so weird that it's so different and they're not taking advantage of some of the possibilities. But I'll say to you as well... please ask them to open up to non-US writers.
Absolutely.
Because as you know, there's lots of action adventure writers.
Yeah, must be some laws about fan fiction, because Kindle Worlds is essentially licensed, approved fan fiction. And maybe there are complications of laws in other nations. I don't know. Or maybe they just don't have their act together.
Yeah.
Who can say?
There
It'll
is
be
that.
An interesting journey.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's super interesting. So you have so many books, but tell people, like, if they want to get started on some of your universe, where should they start with any of your books, and where can they find you and your books online?
Well, if you're cheap, no, I'm kidding. The very first Danematic book, Dorado, is free. Just bear in mind, that's the first book I ever wrote to completion, so go easy on me. And my first David DeBord book, The Silver Serpent, is also free in ebook. Same deal, first fantasy novel I completed. I think they're pretty good. If you already know, for example, with Matic, that you just love action adventure and that kind of thing, the first 6 books are in a book bundle, and 3 of the origins are in book bundle, so you can grab those as well. But the best place to find me, find all my podcasts, Facebook and Twitter, is just to go to my website, davidwoodweb.com. And I love hearing from people. If you want to talk indie publishing, writing, whatever, love to do it. Just reach out on, contact me.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Dave. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.